When you don't go to Geico.com, car insurance can be confusing. Like Swedish techno confusing.
Bark, bark, meow, meow. Dance with me, purple cow. Bark, bark, meow, meow. Ooh, you lovely cow.
Geico makes it easy. With 24/7 access, all you have to do is go to Geico.com and you could save money on car insurance. It just makes sense. Unlike, you know.
Dance with me, purple cow. I like your move.
Welcome to Crime Wire, a program dedicated to bringing attention to unsolved crimes and educating the public about various types of crimes and how to avoid becoming a victim. If you'd like to submit a case to Crime Wire or suggest a topic for a future show, please email us at thenewcrimewire@gmail.com. My name is Denny Griffin, and on today's show, my co-host Delilah Jones and I welcome back Robert Swankowski, Undersheriff of the Oneida County, New York Sheriff's Department. We're going to talk about identity theft and also what to do if you are suddenly involved in a crime in progress. Undersheriff, thanks for coming back on the show.
Thank you very much, Denny. I appreciate being here.
Let's start out, if we could, with identity theft. Identity theft is a crime in which an imposter obtains key pieces of personal information, such as a social security number or a driver's license number, in order to impersonate someone else. The information can be used to obtain credit, merchandise, and services in the name of the victim, or provide the thief with false credentials. In addition to running up debt, an imposter might provide false identification to police, creating a criminal record or leaving outstanding arrest warrants for the person whose identity has been stolen. Undersheriff, please tell our listeners some of the ways identity thieves obtain a victim's information and what we can do to keep from becoming a victim.
Denny, that's going to be anywhere from someone actually misplacing identification or identification being stolen, and that could be physically stolen, whether it's someone's wallet, purse, information taken from the mail. It's also information that some of these identity thefts get online. Also, you receive, we talked about in another show, the scams that are out there. You receive phone calls where people will solicit information from you stating it's regarding an outstanding loan, a car warranty, an IRS matter, whatever it is. One way or another, whether it's through electronic means, the mail, on the phone, or actually physically stealing stuff, there's just a number of ways that thieves are looking to get that personal information. And it's not just your social security number, your date of birth, even your name, address, any other pertinent information that may help them, gain credit or utilize some type of monetary funds with the access they have to your personal information.
And as you mentioned in a previous show, we talked about some of the scams and the online scams and so forth, and we discussed it on that show about when these people contact a potential victim looking for information, personal information, if common sense has to come into play if you are the target, because if it looks too good to be true, if something doesn't sound right, doesn't feel right, if supposedly your financial institution is contacting you about a matter with your account, and the email comes across as dear sir or madam or that type of thing. I mean, they should have the information. They shouldn't have to ask you for it, and they should know who they're dealing with. So it's critical, I think, you'll agree, Undersheriff, that when you're being targeted for one of these scams, whether it's for an identity theft operation or just a financial fraud, whatever it is, you've got to be very alert and, use a good judgment and don't rush into things. Think them over a little bit before you start giving out information to people.
Absolutely. That's one of the best ways to avoid identity theft is have that preparation in mind, you know, that mindset that if someone is legitimately trying to get a hold of you, they already have all that information, you know, verifying sources that are looking for information, making sure they're credible, you know, making sure it's necessary that you give out that information. I mean, simply asking, you know, why do you need my Social Security number if you're just trying to identify? You know, people may say, oh, we're trying to verify who you are. I mean, again, if they're legitimate, you know, it's mostly only financial institutions that you maintain business with or someone you may have a loan through or something like that where they're going to need your entire Social Security number. And even then, most of them only ask for, like, your first three digits or your last four digits.
Yeah, and if is there any advice for a person? Let's suppose that you get one of these phone calls or an email asking you for information, and you do respond right away. Maybe it's the IRS thing threatening that they're going to audit you or something if you don't respond and give them information, and you do bite, and then afterward you start thinking, hey, wait a minute. Something's fishy here. Maybe I shouldn't have done that. Is there anything you can do at that point? I mean, maybe should you contact your bank, for example, where you have your credit cards and just put them on alert, or do you just wait and see if anything bad happens?
Sure. There's about a half a dozen different things that someone should do. And again, whether you willfully, accidentally, or unintentionally gave away this information, or it was actually obtained through some other illegal means, the first thing to do is you could put a fraud alert on your credit report. And if you just contact one of the three credit reporting agencies, whether it's Experia, Equifax, or TransUnion, they will notify the other two. And it's basically a 90-day fraud alert, so it doesn't it automatically declines any new requests for lines of credit or loans or things like that. So we'll automatically decline that. So it basically prevents creditors, except ones you already have business with, from accessing any of your credit reports. Another thing, contact any of your institutions or people, banks that are directly affected. So if you know it's a certain, hey, it was my HSBC card that they got the information from, or it was my auto loan or whatever it is, contact that individual entity itself and make sure they're aware that that has happened. Typically, you'll get issued new cards. They'll close that account. They'll open another account number. They have means to take care of that. Another thing you can do, you can contact the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, and just do an identity theft affidavit. And in order to do that, you'll also need a police report, and that's my next suggestion. But basically, the identity theft affidavit kind of puts you on a list, and the FTC knows it kind of red flags when someone's goes to use your information. But to complete that report, you will need to file a police report. People may be discouraged on the limited amount that police can do in certain cases of identity theft because it may lead outside the country. However, we've been very successful, and we're more and more successful as these crimes occur, because sometimes they are local people that are doing this, and we're able to gather enough intelligence through investigations and catch these people. But it's recommended at very minimum a police report. It just states that whatever information or that you've obtained that has been stolen or misused, that information that's prudent to your identity is documented that was somehow compromised. You want to protect your Social Security number if that's been compromised, and you can contact the Social Security Administration. Their number is actually 1-800-269-0271, and they'll identify the fact that your Social Security number has been compromised, and they make a record of that. They make sure they monitor, you know, any if there's any tax fraud. People try to use your IRS Social Security number to complete tax returns, fraudulent tax returns, and get your money. And another option you could do if you know that happens is you can sign up for a credit monitoring service, and basically they will notify you you pay a monthly or annual fee, and they notify you of any activity at all on your credit report, anything pertinent to your current credit situation or anyone trying to file new things.
Well, you know, I'm glad you mentioned the credit reporting because, and I'm not doing this to plug them, but I happen to have been with LifeLock for several years. I had an account for my wife and for me. And over the years, on two occasions, they have caught fraudulent activity right at the start. As soon as somebody tried to use a credit card that looked suspicious, they reported it, and we got everything straightened out with minimal damage.
And yeah, they're
so
a great service.
I'm happy.
And again, you know, it's something that's optional. You mentioned LifeLock, a coworker of mine, same thing. He got a phone call about a student loan. And he had a student loan, and he gave out a Social Security number, and he started thinking about it, that the company never identified themselves. And he did the same thing. He signed up for the LifeLock. Probably within 3 months, like you said, he got a notification that there was someone tried to initiate a credit application. It was denied. But it's definitely a good service, and it's something good to have out there. Like anything else, just make sure you look into the service, that it's a reputable service. Again, you're probably not going to get something for nothing, so it is going to cost you know, some type of fee.
Yeah, it's like an insurance policy to some degree, I guess. It's, you know, that there is a cost involved, but it can prevent from suffering major financial consequences if you don't have any protection. So I think, at least in my opinion, it's a good investment. You also mentioned that the identity thieves, you know, different places and agencies you can report the problems to, including a local police report and to federal agencies. I'm assuming if something was done through the U.S. mail, you also have a federal issue, maybe using the mail as part of a fraud. And if stuff's done on the internet, I mean, you can be involved actually with multiple jurisdictions, can't you? If you're a victim, you can have federal crimes, local crimes,
absolutely,
and all kinds
absolutely
of stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, you could be dealing with the Treasury Department. You could be dealing with the U.S. Postal Inspection Service, you know, a myriad of different agencies. There's actually a guide on consumer.ftc.gov. That's consumer.ftc.gov. And that kind of walks you through everything that I've talked about, some of the recommendations. But, yeah, you hit it on the head. If it happens, it's a lot of work to prevent some very serious things that could happen. So, you know, you don't really want to wait and say, gee, you know, let's see what happens. The best thing to do is take those preventative measures that might cost you, you know, a few hundred dollars as compared to potentially thousands of dollars, and then trying to repair credit reports and trying to dispute charges. The prevention part, you know, the quicker you act on it, the better.
And yeah, I somewhat, well, I guess now I can say it was humorous to some degree, but several years ago, back in the 90s, I was paying quarterly estimated taxes to the IRS, and I was still working at the time. I was working in security out in Las Vegas, and I had to be to work early in the morning. And we had a mailbox out in front of our place, and you just put the flag up, and the post office would know that you had outgoing mail. So before daybreak, I would put my mail into the mailbox, put the flag up, then go to work. Well, I got a notice one day from the IRS about my tax payment. I come to find out what happened was there was a crew, or at least a couple of guys, and they were going through the residential areas prior to dawn, before daybreak, looking for mailboxes with flags up. And they would open the mailboxes, take out the outgoing mail. In a lot of cases, there'd be credit card payments, in my case, an IRS payment, that were going out, and they would steal these, and of course, open them up, and they get your credit card information, in my case, Social Security number, and all that kind of stuff. And of all the things for them to steal was the IRS. But I ended up dealing with the postal inspector, with the IRS, and with various, and we got the thing resolved. And the only, and they also stole a credit card payment outgoing. And the only thing that went on the credit card was I got billed for $55 worth of fried chicken, a Kentucky Fried Chicken. nothing else happened with that. But again, I was very fortunate, and I didn't know the credit. I didn't know this stuff was gone until I got the notices. So they had this information, whoever, you know, for a while before it came
sure.
to my attention that there was even a problem. And like I say, I was very fortunate. It could have been a heck of a lot worse, but I know it does happen. And these criminals that are out there, I mean, you know, nothing is sacred with them. They'll do whatever it takes for them to get the information from you.
Absolutely.
Well, what other ways, you know, we've talked a lot about electronic ways that they are able to steal your information. What other ways, like, is it true people really go through your trash, so you should shred everything that has your name, address, anything on it? You know, what are your feelings about that?
Yeah, unfortunately, Delilah, it still happens. I mean, people do the old manual, you know, going through garbage, stealing people's mail. I mean, it's a lot easier to steal someone's mail than go through the trash, but still they'll do that. Especially where they in areas that there may be an affluent area or a high population area, you know, maybe a business. Depending if people work in banking industry, some financial industry, things like that. You know, there's a number of ways that people try to, well, pretty much any way they can try to gain information. There's people that on public transit, you know, stand up over people's shoulders and monitor what they're doing on their tablets and their phones and things like that. So just any possible way that they can gain information from people, these people do it. I know there was one ATM scan where people would actually leave a phone near an ATM, and it would basically be capturing information from people's transactions. And it, you know, we started to get in the habit of looking around the ATM to make sure someone wasn't leaving some electronic device around trying to record transactions for information.
So
how easy
you gotta
is
be
it
on your
to do something like that? I mean, I know I've seen reports on news stories and stuff of this type that, you know, gathering up the pings and the sounds and all of that. I mean, maybe I'm not with it too technologically, so it's hard for me to understand just how all of this process can happen.
I know I watched one show where they had a gentleman who could basically read people putting in, whether it was like PIN numbers, just the way the person was moving their hands and where on the electronic device, the guy could actually read with probably about a 90% certainty what the information people were putting in. So again, some of these people, they're not clowns. They're professionals at what they do. There's, you know, the crime industry has professionals in it, and they know what they're doing. They try to circumvent, you know, any detection, you know, as well as know their rights, and, you know, they're very good at what they do.
That's a good point, Undersheriff. These people, like you say, are not clowns. I wish some of them apparently are very talented and very intelligent, and it's too bad they don't apply themselves to legitimate projects. They probably could do a lot of good, you know, because they seem to have quite a bit on the ball, but they choose, you know, to go the other way with their abilities. But yeah, you can't take these people for granted and think you're dealing with, you know, with a bunch of idiots. These people are very sharp. A lot of them, at least, are very, very sharp.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, there's times that even like the FBI, other agencies will, you know, employ or work out conditions with people that have committed crimes that have skills in, you know, hacking and gaining personal information or other fraudulent methods of things, and they'll use them to investigate other crimes.
And I guess who better to use than people who have done it, and especially if they've been overall successful at it. I remember when I first started going to Las Vegas, I did a little research, and they said that the so-called eye in the sky and all this stuff, of course, now it's all cameras, I guess, for primarily, but they used to have their people walking above the the ceilings and the catwalks up there, watching the tables and so forth, and they were hiring card cheats. They'd catch these people cheating at cards, and they were pretty proficient at it, and they'd hire them to use their expertise on how the cheat goes down to monitor the games and catch other cheaters. So, I guess if you're going to hire someone to do that kind of thing, you want to get the best, and probably a successful cheater or scammer or whatever it is you're trying to do is maybe the way to go.
Yeah, absolutely.
Before we move on to the next topic, is there any, just to kind of sum up, is there any message that you'd like to leave with the listeners regarding identity theft?
I think like most things we talk about, and even when we move on to our next subject, prevention. You know, prevention's the key to everything. Trying to minimize, you know, the number of credit and debit cards you use, you know, minimize how open your information is, minimize to what extent you use services online and things like that. Technology offers us a lot of convenience, but sometimes we get a little complacent and we put too much out there. I mean, do you really have to monitor 16 different credit accounts and banking accounts online, or have access to them? Or, you know, is it easier just to maintain that paper trail, the statements you get from the bank and things like that? You know, there's good levels of security, but, you know, people need to keep in mind that everything you put, you know, online, the internet was not designed to be secure. The World Wide Web was not. And that's why we're putting so much money and effort into security features into it now. You know, mail, just simple as, you know, tearing up the mail. You know, you don't necessarily have to shred it, but at very minimum, you know, tearing it up when you're throwing it out. You know, just making sure that you're not giving access to things, you know, such as personal information, not leaving purses and wallets around. So anything from that, you know, the physical ability for stuff for people to take stuff, the ability for them to see it where it's in plain view, in the availability of any potential technological, you know, phishing scams or access that people may get.
Okay, now I'd like to move on to something. We've been talking about crimes that don't necessarily involve physical safety. We're talking about the frauds and things that can be very damaging. They can... You know, if you're a victim of identity theft and so forth, you can lose a lot of money. You can have to go through an awful lot of grief and aggravation to restore your credit and so forth. But next I'd like to talk about where your physical safety may be in jeopardy. And what I'm thinking about is, let's suppose you're driving home at night from somewhere, you stop at a traffic light, and all of a sudden, a couple of thugs come up to carjack you, or you pull into your driveway and you notice maybe that something isn't the way it should be. For example, if it's night, maybe you see what looks like a flashlight beam through your window, or a strange car that shouldn't be there is parked in the vicinity of your place. When these types of things happen, and if you handle them the wrong way, and you walk into a burglary in progress or something like that, it actually can affect your physical safety. So I'd like to talk a little bit about those types of situations and what you should do if you walk into or encounter a situation like that. Is there a time to flee? Should you flee? Should you call 911? Should you investigate yourself? And if worst comes to worst, Is there ever a situation where you really should fight? I know sometimes you're told, well, comply and everything will be fine. You know, you might lose your wallet or whatever, but you'll live. But is there ever a case of maybe there's indicators from your assailant that that isn't going to work and that maybe your only chance is to try to fight for your own survival? So, Undersheriff, could you take us through some scenarios of what a person might encounter or be drawn into where their physical safety could be in jeopardy and what they should do? Obviously, every situation is different, but in general terms, what is the best chance for you to escape and get out of the situation in one piece?
Sure. So I'm going to walk through some basics as far as when we use terminology, because there's a lot of confusion between burglary and robbery sometimes. Burglary is when someone remains or enters into a home or a building unlawfully with the intent to commit a crime therein. So to give you an example, you could have someone that was in your house that you asked to leave, and then they struck you. That would be considered burglary, just as well as someone breaking into your house to steal your jewelry. That is also burglary. So burglary, in the sense people always think it has to do something with stealing, it's actually someone remaining or entering unlawfully into a building or a home, and then with the intent to commit a crime therein. So they don't even have to commit it. They just have the intent to do it. Now, robbery is basically, to sum it up layman's terms, it's forcible stealing, where someone is grabbing that purse off of you or, you know, holding you at gunpoint or knife point or the threat of, you know, to take whether it's property or money. So that's the difference really between the two. Surely any of them are dangerous situations. My recommendation, again, running into something like this, if you can get out of that situation, it is probably the most feasible and safe thing to do is, you know, escaping somehow or fleeing and always notifying 911 when you're in that situation once you're in a safe area away from there. In a burglary situation, whether, you know, if you're home and you think someone's trying to break in your home, one of the first things, if you can, calling 911. Even if you can't say anything, now with the technology, 911 can locate you, whether it's through a cell phone, GPS, or your landline. They'll know the exact location that's occurring. Even if you leave the line open, they will send police there. Second is basically as a deterrent for someone breaking in, because there's a difference between people that are burglarizing places and like home invasions. Burglars, statistically, they avoid violence and they avoid people, and they do a lot of homework to make sure they're avoiding people when they're trying to commit their crimes. You know, simply turning the lights on can make someone avoid, you know, continuing to break in the house and things like that. Again, you know, every situation is different. You have the option in New York State, the law regarding use of force is Section 35 of New York State Penal Law, and that talks about the use of deadly force and deadly physical force. I mention that now because when you're in your home, if you're ever going to use any type of force out in public, your first obligation is to retreat until you can't retreat anymore. So if you don't have the option to retreat, then you're allowed, authorized to use force. In your home, you don't have to retreat, not even if you're assailed by someone from within the house. So whether it was a family member or someone that you're in your own home, you're not obligated to retreat. And I'll talk a little bit more about the use of force down the road. But that, again, it becomes an option if you feel you need to defend yourself in any circumstances where you're in your house. Now, if you come across a burglary where you're going home and you happen to get in your home and you think someone's in there, again, the recommendation is to get out of the home. Go to a neighbor's house, get in your car and leave, and again, call 911. Let the police respond to someone occupying your home. Now, if you see signs of your door is kicked open, a window's broken open, maybe even something's not forced open, but it doesn't look right like how you left it, don't go in the house, call the police, let them do what they refer to as a building search. make sure your home is free from any intruders. Again, they have the equipment and the training to go in and encounter and look for people in those cases. So that kind of covers the burglary part of it. The robbery, the carjacking, they're pretty similar. They're much more violent. People are a little more brazen when they do things like this. They either, you know, sometimes they're not armed, sometimes they portray to be armed, and certainly there are times when they are armed. Again, you know, it is your right to defend yourself. Someone's stealing something from you. Yes, the recommendation is if they're going to take your purse, if they're going to steal your car, the least restrictive method is, you know, let them take what you want, preserve your life and your safety. You know, however, again, going back to Article 35 and whatever laws regulate in other states the use of force, you do have the right to protect yourself, you know, from harm, whether it's physical force or deadly physical force, and meet that force at that level if you're unable to retreat. And again, in any of those circumstances, I can't stress enough to contact 911 as soon as possible. The best thing to do in any case where you encounter someone committing a crime against you, you know, be a good witness, get as much description, you know, whether it's, you know, the gender of the person, the skin tone, the age, the size, the weight, height, any descriptors, clothing, tattoos, things like that, that can readily identify someone that has committed that crime. So that's kind of some scenarios that you could run across, you know, between the burglary, the robbery, the carjacking, that type of thing. And I don't know if you want to get into actual, you know, use of force at this time.
I do want to, you just mentioned about how important it is to get information about what you've seen so that you can relay that to the authorities and hopefully get an arrest if warranted. About what I used to recommend, several years ago we were having problems on our street. There was some burglaries and larcenies from vehicles and so forth, and I suggested, it wasn't a formal neighborhood watch, but some of the neighbors got together to discuss the problem, and we realized that you know, that you can tell the police, or the police obviously are aware if you're reporting these crimes, that a certain area may be having issues, but the reality is that we just don't have enough law enforcement to have a patrol officer or car stationed at every intersection or every block. So I think the citizen has to take some responsibility to help in the law enforcement effort. And we decided in our little neighbor meeting that everyone should have a notepad, put it somewhere handy with a pencil or pen, and anytime they saw something suspicious, for example, maybe a strange vehicle, like I said, it was a neighborhood, you know, a lot of times you know pretty much who's there and who you should see there. And if you saw a strange vehicle, you would write down the date, the time, and a license plate number, if at all possible, or a description of the vehicle, description of an occupant, if you could get it. And you wouldn't necessarily have to call 911 right at that moment. You could if you wanted to report a suspicious person. But at least if the information was there, and let's say a week later somebody said, oh, I've been burglarized, and the police are investigating looking for possible suspect information, you at least would have a record with a date, time, and so forth written down. And at that point, you could pass your information along. Undersheriff, do you think that type of thing is a good idea? Should people take these things seriously enough to want to actually build a record or keep some kind of a record and not trust everything to memory?
Sure, absolutely. They're phenomenal ideas. You know, it's the public who helps us catch people most of the time in burglaries. You know, it's your neighbor that says, hey, you know, I know, you know, Bill and Susan are away, and someone's at their house that I don't recognize. You know, people are hesitant to call 911 sometimes, and then that's our job. Our job is to investigate things. If it turns out that it's not a crime, that's great. But at least at minimum, you know, we're trying. That's part of prevention. Is, you know, we go to things and it's not a criminal act, but that's okay. You know, you're not wasting our time by contacting 911. We've gotten, you know, from any types of criminal activity, we get a lot of information. from the public. You know, that's part of the community policing cooperation. And basically, that's the whole premise behind what we do. You know, while everyone's at work and away and things like that, the police are there to monitor things. And sometimes we still need the help of the public, you know, and it's crucial that people do pay attention to what's going on and that, you know, you do have some good relationships with other people in the community so you can look out for each other. So it's very important, and that's very valid information that we get that you described.
The other thing you mentioned about the use of force and up to and including deadly physical force, I remember it wasn't too long ago, one of the incidents from Florida that drew a lot of attention was the Trayvon Martin thing, the George Zimmerman shooting. And there was a lot of talk in that and in other cases about when was especially a citizen, a private citizen, able to use the deadly physical force. And there are certain things, I believe, and maybe you could share them with us, that you definitely don't want to do, that would definitely not qualify as self-defense or the justifiable use of force. I'm thinking about the, you know, you hear a noise out in your garage, you're a homeowner, you grab your handgun and you go out to investigate. Some kids there, I don't know, browsing around, trying to get some cans to take back to the store to get the deposit. He goes running out, and you chase him down the street and shoot him a couple of times in the back. I mean, that's barely obvious, but there are certain times when you just can't pull out the gun and start blazing away. So could you give us some of those that definitely would get you in serious trouble if you did them?
Yeah, Denny, in general, in most use of force laws throughout the country are pretty much the same, if not similar. It's just where they extend. You talked about Florida. Florida extends that castle doctrine, or that we talk about where you don't have to retreat in your home. They extend it to your car. Some states extend it to your workplace. You should be familiarized in what state you're in. In New York, it's simply your home, that where you do not have to retreat. It's important to know that portion of the law. Typically, they're not long or extensive, so it really behooves people to take a look at your use of force laws, your justification of that use of force, and understand it thoroughly. I can't say a person being in one situation or another, one may use force, one may not, one may use deadly physical force, one may use physical force. The law pretty much clearly defines it that if you believe the threat is actual or imminent, and by actual, so let's use physical force for an example. If I'm kicking you, it's an actual use of physical force. I'm actually kicking you. If I raise my hand above my head and tell you I'm going to punch you, you don't have to wait to be punched to understand that physical force may be used against you. That is an imminent act of physical force. You believe that I'm going to punch you. And the same applies with deadly physical force. If someone's using deadly physical force against you, stabbing you, or someone pulls out a gun, you don't have to wait for them to shoot. You have to believe that that threat is imminent. So it's up to, and that's why the law is designed like it is. It's up to the individual. There's cases where a, you know, 300-pound, 6'4" man attacks a 98-pound, 5'1" woman and starts punching her. Now, to her, that could be deadly physical force, and she may, if, say, armed with a handgun, take that handgun out and shoot the person because she believes if she continues to be hit by this person, she's going to die. Where someone of more equal stature to him, they may just consider that a physical force altercation. So the law is really designed with those specific situation each person may be in mind with how they may deal with it. Now, you talk about the obvious ones. You know, someone's pounding on your door in the middle of the night, you shoot through the door, you're probably going to need an attorney the next day. You know, kids are in your garage and you shoot into your garage because, you know, some kids were rifling through your garage. There's you know, some things that are very blatantly obvious where if you use force and you can't articulate that you were afraid that you were defending yourself from physical force or deadly physical force being against you or a third party, you're going to have an issue. You're certainly going to have a legal issue. And that applies the same thing to police. You know, our force has to be authorized in accordance with law. Our force has to be necessary. We need to do that. And we can't, one of the key things with everyone, we can't be reckless. So even if we're in a mall and someone, you know, pulls out a knife and starts running at me, but there's 13 people behind them, I have to be careful and make sure I know that if I used my firearm, I wasn't going to hit anyone else. Because if I did, that's reckless. I'm still responsible for that. So there's certainly some key things that you want to ensure when you're using force, and that is that there is an act that is actual or that is imminent, which you think is certainly going to happen. That is going to determine if you're going to use force, and then what type of force being used against you. Do you believe, hey, I'm going to incur a physical injury potentially, or you are, or is it to the rise to the level of deadly physical force?
So threat, a realistic threat, or what can be perceived by the victim, potential victim, is really critical then. It's got to be there, and it's got to be where a reasonable person could perceive the event or perceive the activity going on as an actual threat or imminent threat to their safety and well-being.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's where you hear the story, like if you're at your house, you know, and you shoot someone and they're outside, drag them back in. We don't ever want to do that. You're messing with a crime scene. It's not where or how it happens. It's the elements of what is happening and what you perceive. Again, someone broke into the house late at night. Three kids are upstairs. Mom's home alone. She gets a shotgun. She yells out, leave, leave, and the person doesn't leave, and she shoots them. If she articulated, I wasn't fear for my life, that person killing me and then going killing my children, you know, that would be the justification that the law would be looking for. And again, you know, people shouldn't think it's a pass. Hey, let me give you an example. In 2010, in an AT&T store in a village in New York Mills, where I was a police chief and working, a man came in. He shot one of the employees. There happened to be an off-duty police officer there. He shot and killed the shooter. And when we responded, we actually, you know, determined it was an off-duty police officer that shot him. He still was subject to go to grand jury, meaning they would have to look at and see if that force was justified. And that could happen to anyone. You still may have a process to go through that the criminal justice system is going to say, hey, we have to see if that force is justified. So that if just being a police officer, if that was a civilian in that same situation, they would be subject to the same, you know, scrutiny or evaluation. So, you know, a DA's office may send you, or a prosecutor's office, to grand jury to make sure that, you know, it's perceived that you did follow the letter of the law and that, you know, they understand that, yes, you perceived the threat and that you acted accordingly. So it's still very important to understand the elements of that.
And if anybody has questions, like you mentioned earlier, you really need to understand what the law is in your particular area regarding the use of force and deadly force, it would be a good thing. And I know in some cases there are courses that are run that would explain firearm safety and the laws. And I'm sure that people could find even online the guidelines in their particular area for the use of force and deadly force.
Sure. Absolutely, absolutely. All those things you mentioned are out there, whether it's private training classes, the law itself, public information, you know, law enforcement has educational awareness seminars here and there. I mean, it's definitely something, especially the way things are, to just understand what it's another right that you have. You know, no one should be placed in the position of being a victim. And the United States Supreme Court has held that time and time again that, you know, people do not have to be victims of crimes. They have a right to defend themselves. So it's certainly something that, you know, people should take seriously and at least have an understanding of if ever confronted with that situation, and hopefully not, that at least they know what they are allowed to do by law.
Good. Before we run out of time, I'd like to very quickly cover one last type of incident, and that would be what we read about periodically is road rage. And sometimes the situations almost would seem comical on the surface because they seem so petty, and yet they end up with people dead. If in a perfect world, we would all be able to control our tempers and we'd never have any altercations. However, that isn't this is not a perfect world. So there are times when we will encounter a person on the road driving, and that person will do something, or we think they have done something that was stupid or discourteous or what have you, perhaps cut in front of us without a signal light or that type of thing, pass too close. And fingers, you know, the one finger salutes fly back and forth, and then pretty soon somebody pulls over. If you're involved in a road rage situation where somebody's flipping you off, maybe they think you were the culprit, that you've cut in too soon or whatever, and they become kind of unglued over it, what is the best thing for you to do? Obviously, probably the worst thing is to pull over and challenge the other driver, you know, to get out of the car and face up. So what would be the best thing to do if you've reached the point where you've done something wrong or the other driver thinks you did and wants to confront you? How should you resolve the situation? What's the best way?
As long as you haven't been in an accident, if you've been in any type of collision, you need to stop, immediately notify 911. If the person is threatening or swearing or stay in your vehicle, keep the doors locked. If they become a very abhorrent threat, I would then, you know, at least get a distance away from the area. But, you know, you're not obligated to get out of your vehicle and engage the other person. You can wait for law enforcement to arrive. If you haven't been in a collision, avoid the confrontation altogether. Be the better person. Understand that people have been harmed and even killed in road rage situations. It's you know, it's certainly unnecessary, and it's just you know, it's very tragic that something that minute would get people, you know, hurt or even killed. You know, drive away. If the person's following you and you feel they're a threat, again, call 911. That's an emergency situation. I would definitely, you know, get the description of the vehicle, the occupants of the car, the license plate if you can, and let them know, you know, that the person is following you, you feel they're a threat for some reason or another. Even if you made a mistake, people make mistakes. That is what it is. You know, again, you know, the goal to being on the roadway is to being on it safe. We should all understand that people at times make legitimate mistakes, and sometimes they make some blatant stupid mistakes. But at the end of the day, it's no reason, or you won't be justified getting into a physical altercation with someone. And in the case, same thing with the accidents. You know, if a police officer articulates that someone is involved in a road rage incident on an accident report, that could be detrimental even to your insurance in certain cases. So it's something to avoid altogether, and you know, notifying the police in cases like that would certainly be necessary.
Excellent advice, Undersheriff. Unfortunately, we're out of time. We'll have to wrap it up here. I want to thank you so much for being here again today and educating us on how to keep from becoming victims and what to do if we find ourselves in the middle of a crime in progress or a emotional bad situation. And I hope you'll come back on the show again sometime, because you're certainly a wealth of information, and we really enjoy talking with you.
Absolutely. Again, Donnie Delilah, I really appreciate what you guys do and getting the word out on, you know, educating the public about public safety. That's it's extremely important, and whatever you need from me, I'll be around. Thank you.
You're welcome, Undersheriff. And thanks also to our listeners. And until the next time, stay safe, and don't forget to join us on the next edition of CrimeWire.
true, and this is my impression of a politician. I believe in the people, and their cars, and Progressive, and the fact that you, yes, you can plug in Snapshot to save even more money for being a good driver. I also believe in Sasquatch, but more as a joke, but also kind of seriously.
Safe drivers save with Snapshot from Progressive.
I approve of this message, and Sasquatch, if you are real, you can totally be my running mate.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company. Snapshot not available in all states.
Hey, it's Flo, and this is my impression of a drill instructor directing a musical. Tan Hut! Get those tap heels in line and let me see those jazz hands! Are you bundling your home and auto insurance through Progressive? Can you hear me through those sequins?
Bundle your home and auto through Progressive and save.
Left, 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 and step ball change.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company affiliates. Home insurance provided and serviced by other select insurers.